Tensions between the Trump administration and Iran are continuing to escalate.
Iranian proxy forces in Iraq have thought that they could act with impunity, and that if they acted, we wouldn't take strikes against Iran proper. We've made clear 4 months to the Iranian regime that that wouldn't be the case.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 6th, a look at what's next for U.S.-Iran relations. Also on the show, as severe wildfires become more common globally, indigenous experts say that one preventative method involves setting some fires intentionally.
At the core of those tribal or indigenous philosophies, fire is medicine, and when you prescribe it in the correct way, it can enhance and maintain ecosystem service production.
Plus, the foster care system is being scrutinized across the country for placing children in troubling conditions.
What's being accused in a lot of these states where there's lawsuits in play are that you're warehousing kids.
We start in Iran. Let's get going. Over the past few days, dozens of Iranian Americans say they've faced extensive questioning at U.S. border checkpoints.
On Saturday, we started getting reports of people being held at the border, people being detained, people being questioned about their political beliefs, about how do they feel about the situation.
That's Mana Karazi, the executive director of Iranian Alliances Across Borders, and we'll hear more from her later in the hour. And we're also hearing from our Iranian American listeners on this.
Hi, my name is Kiana, and I'm an Iranian American. I am one of many silent but present Iranians who are thrilled at the news. While this might lead us into war, so many Iranians and people who are fighting for freedom across the world are excited to hear that the U.S. is taking action to bring down a horrible, horrible militant.
And over in Iran, a public funeral was held in Qasem Soleimani's hometown of Kerman. According to Iranian state television, stampedes broke out in the crowd of tens of thousands, and dozens have been reported dead. So far, Iranian and American media reports from Iran have depicted mass demonstrations and support for Soleimani, and a country largely united in its opposition to the United States. But our next guest says escalating tensions are also putting Iranians in danger. The Iranian-American journalist Jason Rezaian knows the internal workings of the Iranian government very well. He spent 544 days as a hostage of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran. Today, Jason is global opinions writer for The Washington Post, and he joins me now. Jason, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, Tanzina. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. And you have said that the killing of Soleimani could be the most consequential moment in U.S.-Iran relations in 40 years. Tell us more about that.
Well, look, we've been in a sort of prolonged, protracted, cold battle with Iran for that entire period of time, since essentially the U.S. embassy was taken over by Iranian revolutionary students in 1979, and 52 diplomats were held hostage, as everyone knows. You know, there's been skirmishes, there's been direct conflict from time to time, but this is the first time we've seen such high-level action against such a key figure of the Iranian regime being targeted, frankly, of either the Iranian regime or the U.S. government being targeted in this way. So I think you can't look at it anything other than really the most dramatic event that's happened between the two countries in all this time.
And Jason, as we mentioned, in 2014, you were arrested by Iranian police. You were held hostage for 544 days. How did that experience impact your perspective into the current situation today?
Well, look, I had been living and working in Iran as a journalist for 5 years leading up to that. I've been traveling back and forth between the U.S. and Iran for over a decade when that happened. So I had a good sense of not only what life was like inside Iran and the restrictions that people live under, I also had a very clear view of tensions between the two governments. What I didn't have was that direct experience of being personally suppressed and abused by that regime. I have that in spades now, and I'm no friend of this regime. I would like to see them removed from the scene at some point in the not-so-distant future, and Iranians be allowed to live in a secular democratic society. But in the meantime, there is so much, so many hurdles between where they are right now and the possible democratic future that so many of us aspire to for Iranians, that I'm just really concerned about the consequences that it'll have for ordinary people, the potential for conflict, for more sanctions, and, you know, as we heard in the intro, about, you know, ramifications against Iranian Americans in this country by our own U.S. government.
Given your experience, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what calculations you think Iran's top leaders are making now when they're thinking about their next moves.
So I think oftentimes, you know, it's pretty clear to everyone that Iran does not have the same kind of military might that the United States does. No government, no country has the might that we do. So you can't expect them to play in normal circumstances by normal rules. What they tend to do is take steps that are audacious in nature. I would say that abducting and holding hostage the correspondent or bureau chief for the Washington Post for a year and a half during very high-level negotiations between the two countries is an audacious act, one that's designed to grab attention and fuel emotions. I think we can probably expect to see a similar response, and I don't think it's going to happen over the next couple of days. It'll probably happen over a period of weeks and months. You know, in the past, they've tried to hide their fingerprints and create a sense of plausible deniability, and kind of deflect blame onto regional proxies of theirs. I'm not sure that that'll be the case this time around. I think that there'll be a direct response, and it could happen against targets in the region, against American citizens at different points in the world, against high-level officials. It could also take place in cyberspace. There's a whole range of possibilities. But, the one thing that I don't expect is a full-on military attack mounted by the Iranians against U.S. interests.
We've seen reports coming out of Iran that depict at least mass mourning and mass unification against the United States so far. But there are Iranian dissidents in the country, and I'm wondering how they've been reacting to Soleimani's death and whether they will continue to be able to meaningfully criticize the government in Iran right now.
Unfortunately, people are not able to openly and meaningfully criticize the government there. One of the things that has been a hallmark of the last decade or so in Iran is really the removal of internal dissent. A lot of people who were involved in the protest movements in 2009 following the contested and fraudulent re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad ended up in prison. Many others have ended up in exile. So, most of the opposition that we hear from is not based in the country anymore at this point. That being said, there's a lot of people who are vehemently opposed to even the idea of the Islamic Republic. Some always have been, and increasingly as the situation internally in the country has gotten more difficult for people, people are turning away from it. But I think that I would caution against perceptions of the situation as wholly one way or the other. Iran is a society like any other countries in the world that has a multitude of opinions and points of view of its citizenry. Certainly there are people who are vocally opposed to the regime and have been willing in vast numbers over the recent months and weeks to go out in the streets and protest against the regime. There are also, as we're seeing right now, people who support the regime. And people have support for the regime for a whole host of different reasons. So I think it's a bit disingenuous by a lot of analysts to say that the entire country is mourning the death of this general. That's certainly not true. It's just as disingenuous to say that all Iranians are opposed to the regime, and those who are out in the street right now at these mourning rituals are there because they've been compelled or forced to go.
Soleimani also consolidated Shiite power in the region, and he had real influence in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. What does his death mean, Jason, for those countries and for the region?
I think for in the short term, those groups of Shias in neighboring countries will be looking to Tehran to see if the new general, Ghani, will be a sufficient replacement for Qasem Soleimani. He has a huge shoes to fill, and I think that there will be a lot of skepticism from regional partners of Iran about whether or not this new general can take his place. That being said, no military is based on one person, right? They've created a cult personality around this General Soleimani, but I don't think Iran's strategy in that region is going to change significantly in the months to come.
You've also spoken to career U.S. government officials. We know so far that the Trump administration has had a tense relationship with its diplomatic corps so far. What are government officials telling you about the strike against Iran from a national security perspective?
Well, Tanzina, I think, you know, it's safe to say that the two previous administrations had a whole host of contingency plans of how to deal with different sorts of attacks from Iran. They assess threat levels on a daily and hourly basis. And with the national security, former national security officials that I spoke to over the past few days, they all told me that at various points over the last decade or more, they had the opportunity to target and kill General Soleimani. They chose not to do that because they thought that the risks of a potential fallout of such a move were too great and too unknown. And I think that the fact is, and I haven't heard anybody argue convincingly otherwise, the U.S. government right now under President Trump has no real idea what's going to happen next. And for those of us who are very skeptical of the Trump administration, there are those of us who believe that that they're trying to provoke Iran into a greater conflict. Now, it depends a lot on how Iran decides to respond to this current situation. But the one thing that I would say is that the idea that a wider conflict with Iran would lead to prospects for a better future for that country are very unconvincing. You know, if you look at the two countries to Iran's southwest and to its northeast, Iraq and Afghanistan, you will see what sort of consequences these sort of imposed regime changes have had just in our own recent past. So, you know, I think we should be very cautious about next steps. And I think keeping the possibility for diplomatic resolutions always has to be front and center in your mind, whether or not you intend to go to open conflict with a country or not.
Because of the gravity of the situation, how do you think the media can cover this issue responsibly without being alarmist or without repeating the same mistakes in the past?
Well, look, I think we always have to be very careful of not being just a megaphone for what the administration is saying. And, you know, when we invite top leaders onto influential programs, as is often the case, and they take that opportunity, especially when they've avoided those opportunities in the not so distant past, have to be super skeptical about what they say and call them out on, for lack of a better term, their BS. And I think that's sort of very essential right now in this moment. I mean, we have the tendency of becoming fearful and alarmed very quickly. And I worry that colleagues in the media, especially on television, play into that far too much. On the flip side of that, when correspondents are dispatched to Iran, we have to understand that non-resident journalists, especially U.S. ones who are visiting there, are not allowed to openly report from all points in the country. There are people there from major news organizations right now this week who had visas to go there before the killing of General Soleimani, who's, you know, had a great journalistic opportunity to go to Iran and cover unfolding events there. Well, what they'll find when they get on the ground is they're not free to turn left if their minders tell them to turn right. They're not allowed to go to certain points of the country. They're not allowed generally outside of Tehran, the capital. So it's a very stylized and manicured situation.
Jason Rezaian is global opinions writer for The Washington Post. Jason, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
In June, The Takeaway spoke with two Iranian-born United States citizens after President Trump called off a retaliatory attack against Iran for downing a U.S. drone at the last minute. At the time, Geeve Mufendereski and Monica Razi both told us that they were worried about relations between their home country and their adopted country going forward. Mana, who came to the United States as a toddler in the 1980s, still has family in Iran, and she said she felt helpless watching Iran as a bystander from the United States.
How do you live on a daily basis knowing that there's a possibility that your family is going to be attacked, that you have no way of being able to help them?
Giv first traveled to the United States in 1971 as a college student and has been dealing with the looming threat of U.S. conflict with Iran for years.
The only way you can cope with this is to disassociate yourself from reality and go about doing your daily business. You're constantly living with this fear of anticipation, and then nothing happens, and then something happens. This is not fun. This really isn't fun.
So we wanted to check back in with Giv and Mana in the wake of Soleimani's killing to see how things have changed for them and their communities since June. Giv Mufendereski and Mana Karazi, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be back.
Thank you for having us.
Mana, how have you felt watching the events of the past 2 weeks as they've escalated?
I think in a lot of ways this is our worst fears realized. The last few days I've been spending a lot of sleepless nights trying to help organize our community and try to respond to all the policies and the crises that have come up as part of this. I haven't even had a chance, really, honestly, to think about my own family or even check in with them.
Giv, you've been concerned for decades about the relationship between the United States and Iran. Where would you put the events of the past week as they continue to escalate? Does it feel more extreme than what you've seen in the past?
Quite so. And I believe that the United States has crossed a major red line with the assassination of General Soleimani, in a sense that it basically removed, at least from my perspective, that level of anxiety that existed because of the uncertainties. Now it is certain that this administration will not hold back, and it will attack if it felt like it served its own purposes, and whatever those purposes may be. I am convinced that if the United States decides to attack Iran, it will do so, and that the die has been cast.
When it comes to Giv Soleimani's killing and his legacy in Iran, we're seeing today and over the course of the past 48 to 72 hours, increasing mourning happening in Iran, thousands of Iranians coming out to the streets to either protest the United States or mourn Soleimani. What will his killing do to his legacy in Iran?
He already was a national hero to most Iranians, and he expanded the Iranian defensive perimeter beyond Iran's border to the near abroad of Iran. And that, from a strategic standpoint, that was a quite an achievement. And he will be lionized, and he will be idolized, and he would be eventually, his grave will be made into a shrine, and people will come to Kerman in Iran and pilgrimage. His effect on the Middle East, including in the Shiite and the non-Shiite communities, is no less than what Che Guevara's was to Latin America. And his assassination, which has now elevated him to a level that it will now displace the overthrow of the Mossadegh regime in 1953 as the main ointment in any kind of an Iran-U.S. relationship for generations to come.
Mana, you said that you've been organizing here in the United States. What are you hearing from Iranian Americans or Iranians that are here in the United States?
Unfortunately, our community is pretty divided. And, you know, we have folks who do support war and support a regime change at all costs.
And you, when you say a war and a regime change in Iran or here?
That's a good question. We're talking about Iran. Mm-hmm. There's a good amount of Iranian Americans. The folks who maybe came out after the revolution who don't have family there, even who do have family there, have still been really pushing for this for quite some time. And on the other hand, there are a lot of Iranian Americans, particularly a lot of the young folks. There's a large wave of Iranian students who've been coming the last decade in particular, who all have family, who all have connections there, who are incredibly frightened. We've been doing a lot of organizing around direct response because immediately after the assassination, within hours, local law enforcement and local officials across the country, but in particularly in major cities like Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New York, with large Iranian-American populations, made announcements about increasing surveillance and monitoring. So at a moment when we felt the most threatened and felt the most panicky, our own local governments in this country went ahead and called us the threat instead of trying to calm our fears. On Saturday, we started getting reports of people being held at the border, people being detained, people being questioned about their political beliefs, about how do they feel about the situation. So we've been seeing a lot of just a change in this country already about our status as Americans, as people with citizenship here or people who are legal permanent residents. It's all in a lead up to a war that's feeling very much reminiscent of what we went through earlier in 2003 with Iraq.
Guive, I'm wondering, when you just heard Mana talking about that, I'm wondering if you feel this way, that you might be the recipient of bigotry in this country or stereotyping, given what's happening in Iran right now.
As far as I'm concerned, I haven't been a subject of any kind of bigotry or interrogation or anything of that sort. You know, I sit back in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, practice law, and basically go about doing my business, and I'm not very much in any kind of an activity with different kinds of associations. But I do understand where Mana is coming from in terms of her own experience with the Iranian community and the expatriates and so forth. But deep down, the level of the kind of sorrow that I feel for these kind of events that happen with respect to people in my birthland is not different than what Americans felt at the time when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Some were very pleased that he was killed, and some, you know, were not. But there's this deep sorrow, there's this deep sense of loss of someone who served his country and as a warrior.
Guive Mfendereski is a former adjunct professor of international law at Tufts Fletcher School and an attorney in Massachusetts. And Mana Karazi is the executive director of Iranian Alliances Across Borders. Thanks to you both for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks for having us.
It's been 2 years since the organization Time's Up was born, with the central goal of curbing sexual harassment and assault in the workplace. Time's Up was created by Hollywood celebrities primarily in response to the sexual harassment allegations against producer Harvey Weinstein.
Time's up on blaming survivors. Time's up on empty apologies without consequences. And time's up on the pervasive culture of silence that has enabled abusers like Weinstein.
That's actor Rosanna Arquette outside the New York City courthouse where the Weinstein trial is getting underway this week. At its founding, one of the aims of Time's Up was to shed light on how Hollywood deals with discrimination and to push for guidelines and policies that would keep women in the workplace from being exploited.
I think across all industries, what we're seeing is there is a new level of expected behavior, and abuse of power is not going to fly.
That's Laura Dern speaking to The Takeaway last May. And now, with the second anniversary of Time's Up falling at the same time as the Weinstein trial, we wanted to look at just how much the entertainment industry has changed since the organization's founding. I'm joined now by Rebecca Keegan, the senior Hollywood editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi there, Tanzina.
So we just heard from Laura Dern. I want to play one more thing that Laura told us last year.
Within our industry, there is a lot of change. I've been working closely with Screen Actors Guild on a code of conduct. All companies now have a very new code of conduct in terms of expected behavior on set and in the audition process.
Rebecca, we know that often codes of conduct could be written, but are they really being followed? Is Laura right when she says the industry has had a lot of change?
It's been an enormous and dramatic amount of change in the last 2 years. Virtually every facet of Hollywood, from the agencies to the studios to the guilds, as Laura mentioned, the Screen Actors Guild, have come up with new guidelines basically to prevent the emergence of another Harvey Weinstein. And so far, anyway, people seem to be taking them seriously, as opposed to the old days when they might sort of snicker at a sexual harassment video the HR department asked them to watch.
How different is, because you mentioned the HR department videos, and I think a lot of people who work in more traditional environments are used to seeing those. So how different is that from the entertainment industry when it comes to experiencing or reporting sexual harassment?
Quite. I mean, one of the things that I think makes people who work in film and television unusually vulnerable is the fact that they're on these sets for short periods of time. They're not technically employees of a company. They are independent contractors. So there isn't an HR department that you could go and report to in many cases. And there are also really untraditional ways in which people get jobs. Case in point, think of going for a job interview in someone's hotel room. Well, in Hollywood, that was very common. In most industries, that would be strange.
The Time's Up organization just released a safety guide to address misconduct in the industry. What does that guide represent? Do we know sort of what some of the parameters of safety are in the guide?
Well, a couple of the things that Time's Up addresses in the guide are the situations where so many of these problematic encounters occurred. So for instance, auditions, again, which Laura Dern mentioned in that clip you played, auditions are sort of this strange, nebulous area where power was abused in many cases. The Time's Up guidelines tell actors, if you're invited to an audition in a place that is not comfortable for you, you have the right, and in fact, it would be a good idea to suggest another place. It tells you that you can have multiple people present. It just doesn't have to be you and the director or you and the producer. The guidelines also address nude scenes, which are an area where there has been a lot of discomfort, unawareness about how to deal with boundaries and how to respect boundaries on set. Interestingly, nude scenes have also sparked the creation of a whole new job in Hollywood, which is that of the intimacy coordinator.
We actually spoke to someone at the Takeaway, an intimacy coordinator called Jacqueline Francis, who goes by Jack the Stripper, about her work on the set of the movie Hustlers. Let's take a listen.
Intimacy coordinator is something that is starting to happen in films that portray sexual contact. So we weren't like simulating sex on set, but I was there to be like, are you comfortable with this move? Are you comfortable doing this? If you're not, let's try something else. Like, it's not about doing exactly what you think you're supposed to do as a stripper. It's about doing an expression of what feels right to you, what feels natural to you. So we're working with Constance and Jennifer to be like, well, how would you want to move? If there's a move that you don't enjoy, don't do it. The last thing that we want anyone to feel is uncomfortable.
Are you hearing a lot of that from the folks that you talk to in Hollywood, Rebecca?
Yeah, I mean, I would say nude scenes is an area where there's still a lot of work to be done. There are so many scenarios where people can be made to feel uncomfortable and where they don't necessarily know how or where to express that discomfort. Case in point, my colleagues at The Hollywood Reporter did a piece recently about the actress Ruth Wilson on the Showtime show The Affair and why she had left that show. There had been some mystery surrounding it. It turned out it was largely to do with the way nude scenes were handled and how when she expressed discomfort with them, her concerns were apparently not taken seriously.
We spoke to the actor Mark Ruffalo, also here at The Takeaway, about this new chapter, at least, that Hollywood is in. And here's what he had to say about the changes that he's been seeing.
We're all meeting before we shoot the movie, all of us, the whole crew, everybody. And it's explained to us what discrimination is, what sexual harassment is, all of these things that we have been sort of assuming our whole lives and have been taught cultural norms our whole lives were changing.
Rebecca, is that change also happening among the men in Hollywood, as Mark is sort of alluding to there?
I'm sure every actress wishes she could work with Mark Ruffalo, who is like one of the nicest people in Hollywood. There's clearly a cultural change, regardless of gender, that's happening in the industry. One of the things, however, that comes up that makes me think, okay, there's been a lot of progress made, but there's still some work to be done, is I often talk to people who have reported an issue. I've talked to alleged Weinstein victims, alleged victims of other perpetrators in Hollywood, and they say that they're having trouble getting work. They feel that there's sort of a scarlet letter on them because they spoke up, Now they're considered a troublemaker or a rabble-rouser.
Is that still happening today with the trial going on and the new charges coming out of L.A.? Do you think that that's still happening?
Well, indeed. I mean, in reporting I've done on the Weinstein trial itself, some of those victims have told me they feel that specifically because they spoke up about Weinstein, they're not getting work elsewhere in the industry. The same thing came up on a piece I recently did about women who had spoken up at Fox News regarding Roger Ailes, that they had largely not been able to find work elsewhere in TV news. So on the one hand, we're putting all of these systems in place to ensure that these kinds of behaviors don't happen. What I think the jury is still out on is when people do report, do their careers suffer? Is there adequate support for them?
Rebecca Keegan is the senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thank you.
Inmates at multiple correctional facilities in the state of Mississippi are facing an emergency.
The scene is what I call a massacre. My heart is broken because we failed these guys and we need to fix it.
For the past week, an alarming wave of violence in the state's prisons has led to at least 5 confirmed deaths. Advocates and inmates claim the death toll may be higher. Malika Canada is the founder of the Jaylen Barker Foundation and a prison reform activist in Mississippi.
Since New Year's Eve, I haven't had any sleep until last night. It's been heartbreaking. The most thing of it is fear. What are you going to hear next? At 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm hearing somebody was attacked. 3 o'clock in the morning, you're hearing somebody is attacked. Not being able to help them is the worst feeling that I have had. I just want to change because I have a lot of loved ones that's in there. And I want them to come home one day.
Details of the situation are scarce and sometimes unreliable, with families saying officials are leaving them in the dark. But footage gathered by inmates with contraband cell phones show rundown facilities, fistfights, injuries, and even dead bodies, which they've been sending from the inside. Many of the families say they just want answers.
One of those victims that was stabbed was a family member. You can see him on video being stabbed, them inside the cell stabbing him. And then we call and say, well, where is he? No one is able to tell us anything. So tell us the truth. Let us be there with them because you know that this has happened. Let us be beside them. Let us at least sit in the lobby and say so they can say, well, yeah, he's okay.
This latest violence is only a glimpse at problems within Mississippi's criminal justice system that go back for years. Alicia Santo is a reporter for the Marshall Project, and she's with me now to help us explain what's happening. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a step back here. There are problems within the Mississippi criminal justice system and facilities. Give us a sense of what those are.
The MDOC prison system is extremely understaffed. I'd say that's one of the key problems they're facing and that many prison systems across the country are facing. So when you have a lack of staff, you have a lack of ability to bring people to programs, to have visitors, to let people go to church or work. And you also have a situation particular to Mississippi that we know of where the gangs have a lot of control over the facilities. We did a story about the Wilkinson Prison, which is one of the prisons in Mississippi that's privately run. It's run by a company called MTC. And in an audit that we obtained that was meant to be internal, the prison officials actually admitted to auditors that they relied on gangs to run the facility due to the lack of staff that they had. And if the control did not come forward, if they didn't actually keep control of that particular pod, then they would go on to lockdown. And it kind of leads to this cycle where a lockdown where people can't move leads to very, very high tensions. And as soon as those doors open up, that's when the violence comes pouring out.
Is that what we're seeing now with this latest wave of violence in these Mississippi facilities?
I think it's something you have to think about in the background of what's been happening that led up to all of this.
So we here at The Takeaway reached out to the Mississippi Department of Corrections for comment on what was happening. The extent of their response was a link to a statement that they had published on January 3rd. The statement says that a lockdown will continue in the state's prison facilities while they investigate the recent violence. Have you heard anything else from officials in Mississippi right now about the state of what's happening?
So far, a lot of questions have remained unanswered, including how many other people were injured and what other incidents might have occurred other than the ones that resulted in death. We've often relied on public records requests to do our reporting with MDOC. I mean, I can't say they've never answered questions. They certainly do at times, but I think it's a lot more reliable to use public records law in order to just get the documents.
We heard at the very top, Alicia, from a woman who says she has loved ones inside of these facilities. She's probably not alone. There are many people who do. What information is getting out to folks, the loved ones of inmates right now? Are they able to find out whether or not their friends and or family are safe in these conditions?
Well, as you heard from her and others have said, no, they're not able to get that information. And, you know, that's nothing new either. As we've been doing this reporting, we've been contacted by families who say, for example, that their loved ones have been being extorted, that they get calls that their loved one is telling them that they are going to be raped or assaulted if they don't transfer money into their account so that they can pay off someone else who's saying that this is what they're going to do. And we've heard this from a lot of people. And then those family members will call over and over and over saying, my loved one's in trouble, you need to move them, you need to transfer them, and nothing happens. It's tough because when you have these lockdowns, the phones are also restricted. So unless you have a cell phone, which a lot of people do, but not everyone does, there's really no way to let people know what's going on with you. So I can't imagine what those people are going through.
What about the weapons that are found in these facilities? I mean, tell me a little bit about the actual violence that we're seeing happening here. How are people dying?
We acquired some data from a public records request that documented incidents from July 2016 through June 2019 at the state's six largest prisons, and that includes the ones where some of these murders happened. And over those 3 years, prison officials reported confiscating 4,634 weapons. That's what they have reported in there. Now, I should add that they call these reports working documents that haven't been verified, but it's not clear if they track or use the data they have, but this is what they have in their reports. And that's an enormous number of weapons. The thing about these prisons is they're falling apart internally, which makes it really easy to make weapons because then you have exposed metal. And you can take out pieces of pipe and pieces of the walls and then shape those into weapons. Another thing, too, to keep in mind about weapons is everyone has weapons because everyone has weapons. Like, if you're alone in your cell and you know everybody has weapons, then you want a weapon, too. I mean, it kind of, like, feeds itself. The more available they are, the more everybody feels they need to have one.
Alicia, we're talking about people who have been killed, the weapons that are here, the conditions of the prisons, which are abysmal. Where is the head of the Mississippi Department of Corrections? Where is the governor in all of this? Like, why is this allowed to continue happening?
It's a great question. The commissioner just resigned just in the midst of all of this. One of the issues about prisons and funding is, I think, and I've been told this in other states as well, a lot of Department of Corrections very strongly believe they need more money, they need to pay people more, and they would like if legislatures would give them more funds in the budget. But it's not a popular cause for a state lawmaker to say, and I think we need to up the corrections budget by this much. Like, that's not a stand that a lot of voters are going to feel really strongly about and support. In some states, such as Alabama, for example, where there was a cache of photos that showed very, very violent, bloody scenes inside of Alabama. Now you actually have something you can say, we have to change it. And in some ways, it makes it actually easier for a Department of Corrections to get money when there's a huge crisis. Unfortunately, it shouldn't have to get to that point before you actually fund a prison. You want to send millions of people into prison, but you don't want to fund it. And that's, you know, that's what's going on across the country.
Is that what stands between what's happening now and keeping inmates safe?
I think money's a huge part of it, but it's not everything. But if you pay people, at Wilkinson, they pay people $11.25 an hour. If you pay people $11.25 an hour, which turns out to be about under $24,000 a year, and then you can't recruit people, it's a huge reason why you can't get anyone to work there. Besides it being a really dangerous environment to work in for an individual. I mean, it's scary.
And to be a part of if you're an inmate.
Exactly.
Alicia Santo is a reporter for the Marshall Project. Alicia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. We'll be back tomorrow with more coverage on the situation in the Middle East. And we're hearing from you on this. How are you and the people in your community reacting to the increasing tensions between the U.S. and Iran?
Hi, my name's Beth from Pittsburgh. My husband is an Iranian-born U.S. citizen. We're traveling to Israel in 2 weeks, and now we don't know what to expect when we come back. Will we be allowed back home? We got married last year, and the travel ban prevented much of our family from coming to the wedding. It feels like living in the Twilight Zone.
This is Brandon from Garland. I just feel like almost anything Trump does at this point is a distraction from his impeachment. And the bigger the distraction, the better off his chances are for re-election.
Keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.